Star. Well, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah.
You want to start?
Yeah, sure. Welcome back, everyone, to All Good in the Brotherhood podcast. I am Brother Francisco, and this is my brother, Nate.
As always, yeah.
And joining us today is Dr. Paul Kengor, professor at Grove City College in political science, and also the author of many books, Ronald Reagan scholar. Actually, if any of you heard about the Ronald Reagan movie that came out this summer, that was based off of a book, The Crusader, that Dr. Kengor wrote. I did go see it, by the way, in the theater.
If you haven't seen it, go see it.
Yes. Yeah. I went with a friend.
Actually on TV at this
point. Is it on TV? Okay.
Yeah, it's now on, you know, streaming and Netflix.
I think I saw it on Prime the other day. Yeah.
Right.
Sweet.
Right. It had a good theater run.
It did, yeah. It
ran for like 8 to 10 weeks, did really well at first, And the first week it was behind only Wolverine.
Okay.
And then we actually had a
That's
few
pretty good
days.
Competitor.
Yeah, we actually had a few days after the weekend. It was like a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday where we beat Wolverine.
Wow, that's crazy. That's really awesome.
Oh my gosh.
But that didn't last long.
No.
But still, I mean, that's awesome.
Right, right.
When I went, it was a couple weeks after it had gone out come out. When I went with a friend of mine, and we watched in the theater. We went to like one of the early showings. It was like 10 a.m. and it was like everyone in there was probably like 60 or over.
Yeah.
But they clapped when we came in because they're like, "Yeah, young
they
people."
Still remember being alive when he was president.
And really, I mean, like, so first of all, I know their parents. And speaking of the brotherhood, so I've known them since first time I met Nate. He was in a baby car seat.
It was
at our friend the Homan's house, and we just met him.
Oh my gosh,
just met his
that's
parents.
Crazy.
They had just come to town. We were being introduced, and my daughter Amanda was in one car seat. You were in another car seat. So I've known you guys for over 20 years.
Yeah,
that's wild.
But in regard to the Reagan movie, we had trouble getting young people for a little bit, but it was mostly, I would say we had trouble getting young people,
but
people of that era just flocked.
Yeah,
sure,
yeah.
Sure.
And like your parents, I saw your parents showing in Grove City. And they could tell you, it's like you're kind of almost numb just going back in time to the 1980s and thinking. It captures the period really well.
Yeah.
And a movie like that takes you back to that period, it's like, oh yeah, I remember that sound, that feel, that almost smell. You could almost smell it, even though you can't smell it because you're watching it.
Right.
But it takes you back. It's a neat thing.
Yeah, it's kind of funny with that, and I don't know if you ever watched the show Stranger Things. It's set in the 80s and very nostalgic for people from that time period.
Is it? I should check it out.
It's funny. You almost get vicarious nostalgia. Like I was born in 2002, but watching it, I like almost miss the 80s, which doesn't make any sense.
80s was a great time.
Yeah.
I mean, so we're recording this in 2024, so it would have been 40 years ago. And so speaking of, you know, being a Reagan scholar, we had the election of Donald Trump not that long ago, and a lot of people are saying, you know, it was a gigantic victory, a massive victory. Well, you know, he did well in the Electoral College. It was 312 to 226. Reagan won the Electoral College in 1984. 525-13.
That's insane.
Unreal.
49 out of 50 states, almost 60% of the vote.
Was it only Michigan that won?
It was only Minnesota.
Or Minnesota, sorry,
In fact, so people say, well, Minnesota is the home state of Walter Mondale, who Reagan ran against. Reagan twice lost Minnesota. It's the only, Minnesota's very liberal, kind of out in the middle of nowhere. It's like a total anomaly. You look at that map.
That's what I've wondered.
It's like, well, Minnesota blew again.
Yeah.
But the only state that Reagan never won, 80 or 84, was Minnesota.
Huh.
So he twice won California, our
which
home
is
state of
crazy. Yeah.
New York, New Jersey. Reagan twice won Massachusetts.
That's crazy.
So that's how popular Reagan was.
Right.
And that's why so many people from that era, when we put out a movie on Reagan that respects Reagan and you know, doesn't try to be, you know, over the top, and some people call it hagiographic, right? But it's really not hagiographic. I mean, the guy won the Cold War. Won that many states, really loved his wife that much. In the end, does he ride off into the sunset on a white horse at his ranch? Yeah,
because he actually did.
Yeah,
you don't have to be hagiographic if a guy's just actually an amazing person.
Right. It was a spiral ride. Yeah, he and Tip O'Neill, so Reagan's Protestant, Disciples of Christ denomination, Tip O'Neill, Catholic, and Reagan comes out of it after the shooting, and he and Tip are praying together. Tip is holding a rosary, and they're reciting Psalm 23. And I mean, that, you know, can you imagine Nancy Pelosi and Donald Trump?
It's a crazy thought, no.
But no, yeah.
But the only negative reviews we got, well, we got quite a bit from critics, but kind of largely like partisan,
yeah, sure,
ideological critics on the left. I looked at their birth dates when I could find out. They were all born like after 1989. Mm. So I think that they just can't
they imagine miss, yeah,
that there was a time when everybody the liked the president.
Right.
Even if they didn't vote for him.
Yeah.
They all liked him. So yeah, you know, they all want unity. We gave them a film about unity.
Right.
And they hate it.
Yeah. Right. They also can't imagine a time when communism was really a threat. Like, I think our younger generations just don't take communism that seriously because we haven't been alive for it.
Right, right. And I sense a lot of that, too. Mm-hmm. In some of the reviews, they aren't anti-communists.
Yeah.
So a movie, the central thread is about the Cold War and opposing communism.
Yeah.
If you don't care about that issue, you're not going to like it. And the other one, the hagiographic comment that we got was, there's no way the Reagans loved each other that much.
Mm.
I mean, he's in a canoe called the True Love, and he's rowing it outside the Reagan ranch.
Husbands and wives don't love each other.
She's reading this love letter, you know, giggling. No, it's true.
Yeah. Mm.
They were head over heels for each other. Didn't make that up either. You know, no. Sorry, folks.
Sorry, people.
Sometimes truth
true
is
love,
actually said.
Yeah. We could have the movie end with a mushroom cloud over it. No Berlin Wall goes down. Reagan loses 40 out of 50 states. I don't know what you want us to do.
That'd be all fiction, though.
Yeah, that'd be all fiction.
Right.
Then maybe
well,
maybe
that's what we want sometimes.
Yeah.
But.
Right.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
So besides your work in Reagan, so you've, a lot of the books you've written have been like political history, stuff on communism, but there's also been certainly spirituality woven in there, the Pope and the President,
right.
And one of your more recent books, The Devil and Karl Marx, a darker spirituality, but your most recent book on the stigmatists, what is it, their wounds, revelations and warnings, right?
Yes, I think something like that.
What is
it? Right, it's right here. We can just look at it right
their
here.
Gifts, their revelations, and their warnings.
Okay, they,
so, yeah, I brought it with
check
me
it out.
Just in case.
So I was, I remember, I think it was sometime last year, you were talking about your research in it and that you were working on it. And it just, to me, I was really excited, but also a little surprised. It seems like a bit of a dynamic shift to a much more of a just clearly ecclesiastical, but also spiritual work. So just in general, what motivated you initially to write about stigmatists?
Well, as you know, so most of my books contain spiritual elements, right?
Right? Yeah.
So right. God and Ronald Reagan, in fact, not to open this, but I remember the Cabrini movie that came out.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I did some reviews on it, and I complained in the reviews about how there's literally not a single mention of God.
It's crazy.
Jesus isn't mentioned one time. You don't even see the little nun praying. And all through.
Mm, wow. Yeah.
When you see the
nuns
movie,
pray.
Yeah. Right,
sorry. Right.
Well,
when you see the movie Reagan, I mean, it's one of, another thing that the critics hated about it, the left wing critics, is that it starts off, well, my mother always told me everything happens for a reason, according to God's divine plan. Mm-hmm. So there's God is mentioned throughout it. So I did spiritual biographies, God of Ronald Reagan, God George W. Bush. I even did a book called God and Hillary Clinton, which you know, wasn't...
Oil and Water?
Yeah, it was... I wanted to give people... So the publisher, HarperCollins, wanted me to do more of these spiritual biographies.
Yeah.
And so Hillary Clinton was up and running at that time. And she was... I wanted to talk about somebody who was religious left, her views, so I did that book. I also did on Reagan, a Pope and a President.
Right.
Reagan and John Paul II, which opens with Fatima. First of all, a shooting of the Pope on the feast day of Our Lady of Fatima, May 13th, 1981, and then bounces back to Fatima. By the way, for a lot of my longtime Protestant readers who read God and Ronald Reagan and everything, imagine they pick it up and they're like, these three shepherd children in Fatima? What is this?
Yeah, right.
So it's always been, faith is always a thread in all these books. And I did one with Scott Hahn's house, Emmaus Road Publishing, The Worst of Indignities on the Church and Slavery. Mm. I like to do more books on spiritual topics if I could, but oftentimes I'm so overcommitted by publishers
that
are coming after me and asking me to write. At one point about 3 years ago, I was working on five books.
Oh, my gosh.
That's wild.
That's crazy.
But when you're doing books like The Devil and Karl Marx, which are really dark, Devil and Bella Dodd, I did. Infiltration of the church.
Yeah.
That fortunately has kind of a happy ending because she converted.
Right.
Machine. Mm-hmm. Good story. But subjects like this, I mean, at night, during the day, my day job, after researching Karl Marx, communism, lecturing on it, speaking on it, writing on it at night, I'd say, man, I need to cleanse myself. So let me grab this biography of Padre Pio, right? And I've read so many books on Pio. I love Pio. Let me grab the dialogue of Catherine of Siena. Let me read the biography of Catherine of Siena by Raymond de Capua. How about Faustina's diary? In fact, right now at home in my office, you guys have been to my house many times. But on the desk, I have Faustina's diary right there and Gemma Galgani's diary. And at night, if I don't feel like reading anything else, I'll just pick those up and read a few sections. And so many of these different folks have been stigmatists. It's almost a coincidence that they just happen to be.
You weren't seeking those out because they're stigmatists, you just realized.
Happen
to be. Yeah.
No, I wasn't. But at the same time, I've always been fascinated in the phenomenon of stigmata. And I mean, I was born in December 1966. I was baptized Catholic, raised in the Catholic Church in the 1970s.
Oxymoron.
Raised Catholic, 1977.
Yeah, Robbie George asked me one time, he said, Paul, tell me your conversion story. And I said, well, I was raised in the Catholic Church in the 70s.
Enough said.
Say less.
The dark ages. So I became an agnostic in college, went to University of Pittsburgh, was pre-med, majored in what you majored in, biochem. Biochem, biophysics. And eventually came back into the faith basically through evangelical Protestants. I mean, they're the ones who kind of saved me, right? I mean, I was a Christian because I was baptized, but I wasn't a good one. I mean, we're doing this at our church where Father Mike, who was our pastor a couple pastors ago, I remember he used to say, there's no such thing as a bad Catholic. I hate it when people say that. I'm sitting in a pew saying, I was a bad Catholic, man.
Yeah, right.
Really bad Catholic. I'll tell you all about it. So,
I said just kind of a stupid thing to say. God rest his soul, but that's a stupid thing to say. So, did you, when you were like bridging that gap back from agnosticism to being a practicing Catholic, you said Protestants helped bring you back into the faith. Did you spend some time as an evangelical?
I did, yeah. I really became basically an evangelical.
Okay.
And then the first church that I joined was a Presbyterian church, Presbyterian Church, PCUSA, Presbyterian Church of America, or Presbyterian Church USA. There's a whole bunch of different Presbyterian denominations. In fact, they call them the split peas.
I like that.
PC, PCA. My closest colleagues at Grove City College are usually the Anglicans and the PCA, OPC, Orthodox Presbyterians, because they're more creedal.
They have doctrines, something.
Exactly right. And they say with evangelicalism, it's, in fact, who wrote A Purpose-Driven Life? Rick Warren. You know, the problem with a lot of this is that it's about an inch deep. It's a mile wide, but an inch deep. So it's great for bringing people in. But then once you get in there, you realize that there's got to be more out there than the pastor's preaching, the music and everything else. So you eventually kind of end up in a denomination. I did. And then did that until, I mean, to make a long story short, April 2005 when I came into the church at the death of John Paul II.
Wow.
I think it was that weekend.
That
we joined the church. And it was here, I think.
I remember being there. That was the last Easter vigil at the old church.
Yes.
You remember that?
Correct. I do remember that. Yes.
That's right, because I remember the day he died. So at that point, I'm trying to think through the dates. At that point, I think I was still technically not converted yet. I don't think I had well, I'm a revert, so I but I hadn't come back. My wife was a full convert.
Okay.
Yeah, and so I remember going in and thinking, I shouldn't say this, it's going to sound negative about the pastor at the time, who was a great guy, and I won't name him. But I thought, wow, I'm now Catholic, and I'm going to go to a Catholic church on the day that John Paul II died. This is perfect. I get to hear the best sermon of all time. I came in, and
oh boy,
his death wasn't even mentioned.
Are you serious?
I thought, am I losing my mind? This is like the Twilight Zone. Did he die today?
That's crazy.
Did he die?
And instead, it was just surreal.
A reading of going through the readings. And how does this apply to you? And then that was it. No mention. I thought, I need to go to the Baptist church.
Maybe at least someone's going to talk about
it. Talk about it.
John Paul II.
Right. I have a better chance there.
Yeah. But it was...
That's crazy.
The one thing about those churches, you had great sermons. Mm, they didn't call them homilies. They call them sermons. But throughout that time, I was always interested in the supernatural. I knew about stigmatists because of Padre Pio. I mean, Padre Pio is a contemporary. He died in 1968. Yeah. He was canonized about 3.5 decades later after that, over 30 years after that.
Right.
We saw pictures. We saw video of Padre Pio. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know anybody who denied that Padre Pio was a stigmatist. I mean, you had this friar at San Giovanni Rotondo in Italy, central Italy, who was bleeding from his hands.
Yeah.
And in this book, I quote at length doctor's reports. The guy would bleed about a cup a day.
Wow. That's insane.
And you would have a priest who would go in and say, a visiting priest or whoever. I quote one of the visiting priests. It's Monsignor Cardi, who wrote, I think, the first English book on Padre Pio. And he said, yeah, I'm watching him do Mass. And you can see he has trouble closing his hands, consecrating the Eucharist. Wow. I think he had almost like pinch it between his fingers.
That's crazy.
Because he couldn't really fully close it because he had a hole through his hand.
Yeah.
And people would ask him, does that hurt? He's like, yeah, it hurts. Hmm. You know, drive a screwdriver through your palm.
Yeah.
So he had trouble doing that. And Cardi said, and when you would watch him, he had trouble walking because he had holes in his feet.
Right.
Yeah. Every day for 50 years. I mean, some of these.
Did he have a wound in his side?
He had one in his side, and because of the feet, the wound in the feet, Cardi said when he would descend from the altar, he would have to kind of go backwards on his heels almost.
So he's not making contact hard.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, it's all kind of stuff that obviously no one can fake.
Yeah.
No kidding. Right. Yeah.
Right. You'd stop the.
Devote decades of your life to pretending to have wounds. Yeah.
Right. Not, yeah. And no. It really, in fact, Pio said what hurt him the most was not the physical wounds, but the doubters, especially doubters among clergy.
Yeah, and his own order. I mean,
and his own order. Yeah, people who thought he was making it up, or
self-inflicting.
Yeah, self-inflicting, and he's like, how could you possibly? So, and every doctor would say, you can't cause those self-inflicted wounds, especially every day for 50 years. Mm-hmm. They never. You know, they never get infected. Mm. They constantly bleed.
That's incredible. So it's always like they're fresh every time.
Yes, yeah, so, yeah, they're constantly fresh. He would have these incredibly high temperatures. Mm-hmm. I know this sounds crazy.
I've heard of this. He radiated heat.
Yeah, you'll be incredulous about this, right? But one of the reports says the guy hit a Fahrenheit of 118.4.
Oh my gosh.
That's recorded. It's actually documented.
That's incredible.
And they said that in his case he would have this reaction sometimes when he was around sin. It was almost like his body was physically reacting in a kind of toxic way to the feeling of the sin that was around him. So things that would kill anybody else didn't kill him.
Yeah.
And one of the crackpot psychiatrists, and there were a bunch of them around him, one of them who was from, it was Gemelli from the Vatican, he was horrible. And he was really,
like a doubter.
He was so cruel.
Yeah.
And he said, I figured out what this is. First of all, what we need for Pio are not doctors, but psychiatrists to look at him, you know, like him.
It's always the answer, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Modernists. Wanted to put his leg in a cast, wanted to wrap up and all this stuff, which would have, I can't say would have killed the guy because nothing would kill him.
Yeah. Indestructible.
In the hands of God, he was indestructible. But he said, what's really going on here is that Pio and Father Benedetto, the superior, they are in a, what I would describe as an incubus-succubus relationship, right? It starts going up.
What?
Weird, like, Freudian.
Oh gosh, dude. Pot. That's insane. This is a guy from the Vatican?
Yeah, Gemelli. He was really terrible. He was really prejudiced against Pio. And another said, the wounds are being caused. It's clear that they're really wounds. You could not fake this. This is something that is biologically happening. Mm-hmm. But it is being caused, I hypothesize, by autosuggestion.
Oh, I think I heard about that. Yeah. Does that mean it's basically like psychosomatic, like you thought of it yourself?
I don't know. Like if you sit there and look at your hands long enough.
Something happens. That's
suddenly you have a wound showing up. Yeah. A
wound showing up, both hands, then hit your side. Then hit your feet.
Right.
Why not?
Didn't Padre Pio have a comeback to that?
Yeah, he said, tell him to imagine that he's a bull, and let's see if he sprouts horns.
I love that.
From his head. And the ones that are even kind of more shocking in a way than Pio's, that'd be even harder to fake, are the case with many women who would get the wounds in the hands and the feet like clockwork on like Thursday, Friday.
But they would appear, right? And then they would disappear.
Saturday morning, they're completely gone.
That's crazy.
So it's like Thursday morning, they call in the doctors, they call in the priest, and everybody's like, come on, here she comes, come on, watch. Then, she starts to slowly go down. Pretty soon, she's in bed. Now she's really suffering, gets worse and worse, and by, noon, 3 o'clock on Friday, I mean, it's really like she's on the cross.
That's incredible.
She's in complete pain. She's completely wiped out. And then after that, starts to get a little bit better. And then Saturday morning, she's up and around, bouncing around the house, and there's no marks at all.
Yeah.
So you can't make that up.
Yeah, it seems like even if you could try to fake creating the wounds by self-infliction, you couldn't make them disappear.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. You couldn't make them disappear and suddenly no longer have. And I quote the doctor's reports. Pio and some of the others, also Francis, who was the first, other than maybe St. Paul. That's something I talk about in the
book. St. Paul.
Yeah, but with Francis, they even said you could see nail marks protruding.
Oh, my gosh.
At the back of the hand. And in some cases, like Pio, you could see all the way through. The holes went all
transparent.
All the way through. But it's believed that St. Francis was the first, September 17, 1224, so 800 years ago. But if you read in Scripture, St. Paul says, I bear in my body the marks of Jesus Christ, which in Greek is stigmata. And he says that in Galatians. I think it's Galatians 6:17. And some think that in his case, he's not just talking there metaphorically, because he talks about being shipwrecked, scourged, 40 times this, and flogged. And in that case, maybe they think he's bearing the marks of Jesus. But he seems to be, in that case, he might be referring to actual wounds of Christ, akin to what he had on the cross.
Right. Which I was thinking about because, from, a non-Catholic perspective, or even from those who are Catholic, kind of wondering, like, well, one, what is the basis of this? Why would people experience this? And kind of wondering, oh, is this just like this made up strange experience? But if it's rooted in Scripture, then, that adds a credence to it. But I was reflecting on not only that line, but Paul also says that I am making up in my body what is lacking in the sufferings of Christ.
Right.
And I think a lot of people translate, especially, in Catholicism, that's how I've been normally told to translate it, is Paul is not talking about, Christ's own suffering himself on the cross, but the body of Christ, the church, not taking up our need to also offer up her suffering on behalf of others.
Right.
But I think maybe I was just wondering this earlier today, could you posit that also potentially as another indicator of his? I am in my very body suffering it by extension the way Christ suffered. And then in 2 Corinthians, he talks about asking God to remove the thorn from his side. And I wonder, what if it was like
we always feeling wonder what that means,
the
right?
physical wounds of Christ in his side, and that it just kept him from doing the missionary work he wanted to the extent. And what Christ, my grace is sufficient enough for you. So that, and for Christ himself, right, the wounds that he bore were excruciating, and it was only through abandoning his will to the Father that he was able to endure the wounds. So, the scriptural basis of stigmata, bearing the wounds of Christ, I think is very evident in St. Paul. But something you mentioned...
on that point, though, I addressed this in the start of the book, being a former Protestant, right? I know that they will say, are you saying that the suffering of Christ is insufficient, right? They don't need to suffer like Christ did. Is the atonement on the cross insufficient? No, it is sufficient. But for whatever reason, Christ, God the Father, throughout history, and we think there have been maybe 400 to 500 stigmata.
Oh my gosh.
Which is way more than I thought there was.
Everyone knows Francis, Assisi, and Pio, but that's crazy.
Yeah. They know those two. But they may have been, so everyone's called to a different type of charism, right? You're called to prayer, you're called to ministry. And I would tell my Protestant friends, right? Well, why does Billy Graham need to preach, right? Yeah. Why do you need doctors and EMTs and first responders if Christ alone can heal, right? Yeah. Why do you need people to pray? Why do nuns go into the cloister and just spend all their time praying, right? What's your specific... So for whatever reason, these very unique individuals have been called to share in the suffering of Christ on the cross and offer up their suffering and to help atone for the sins of the world. Yeah, yeah, could Christ do it all alone? Yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. But for whatever reason, you have, and part of this is Catholicism versus Protestantism.
Right. Mm-hmm, sure, I mean, yeah.
Protestants will say, brother, in your church, you go in there and you've got Jesus hanging on the cross, mm-hmm. right? But Christ is risen, brother, right?
Yeah.
The cross
yeah.
is empty. We know
yeah.
that. We right. know that. All right, but when you... But when you
wait, really? That's right. News to us.
Right.
That's
but,
crazy.
But when yeah. you walk in as a Catholic and you're suffering, and you'll hear, and I used to hear this in evangelical circles all the time in the 1990s, why does God let bad things happen to good people, mm-hmm. right? Why, Lord, why? Why are these people... It's like, I didn't come into this Christianity stuff for this, right? Mm-hmm. Kind of like health and wealth gospel. Mm-hmm. But I remember one of the first times I heard this as a convert, it was in this room, in this library, and there were three older women in the church, and one was really suffering, and the other one said, hey, offer it up. And I kind of jumped in, and I said, what do you mean by that? What does offer it up mean? Mm-hmm. And they tried to explain, right, that, well, if you're suffering, and what good can you do with this suffering? Just suffering for the sake of suffering seems bad. So mm-hmm. maybe you could turn to Jesus and say, could you take this suffering, Jesus? Could you do something with it, mm-hmm. right? Could you offer it to somebody? Gemma Galgani, one of the stigmatists that I talk about,
right.
there's a moment when Jesus says, have you offered prayers for the suffering souls in purgatory lately?
Hmm.
And she says, no. And he said, do so. You have no idea how much offering up your suffering helps. And I said I was going to mark this one page.
Right, right.
So this is Jesus talking to her. And she says here, one evening when I was at prayer, this would be April 1899, Jesus said to me, do you see this cross, these thorns, these nails, these bruises, these tears, these wounds, this blood? They are all works of love and of infinite love. Do you see how much I have loved you? Do you really want to love me? Then first learn to suffer.
Hmm.
It is by suffering that one learns to love. Yeah, it is by suffering that one learns to love. And I also quote Elena Aiello, who said, people need to understand, as Jesus has told me, he's told her, that it is suffering is not the evil in the world. Mm-hmm. Sin is.
Mm-hmm.
So suffering can be used for a positive purpose. Mm-hmm. So these people who have been called living crucifixes,
mm-hmm.
they get that theologically. So right. they're willing to unite their suffering with Christ on the cross. Now, maybe if we asked for something from Jesus supernatural, we'd ask for like maybe levitation.
Right. Yeah.
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 Something glorified. Right. Right. Right.
Yeah.
That'd be nice for getting all the stuff done.
Around the air. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Most of us wouldn't say, you know, Jesus, let me have the, and by the way, they don't ask for this.
No.
But right. They're given it. And then once they have it, no matter how intense the suffering is, many of them want to do more.
Wow.
And Gemma Galgani, even in one of her Visions, Conversations with the Virgin Mary, said, tell Jesus that when I get to heaven, I'm willing to suffer more, more with him. And Mary says,
heaven?
Yeah, and Mary says something like, my daughter, in heaven, there's no suffering.
Mm,
you don't need to do that anymore.
Yeah.
Right? The suffering all takes place here.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what they were called to do. That was their charism.
Yeah.
And I know theologically it might be difficult for some people to accept, especially in the health and wealth gospel.
Sure.
You don't all know the ways of God. And
no.
again, like you said, read Paul in Corinthians, read Paul in Galatians. And two of the stigmatists, German women, and Catherine Emmerich, right, one of the greatest visionaries in the history of the church, had all the visions. She's inspiration for Mel Gibson's The Passion.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. And also Therese Newman as well. So Anne Catherine Emmerich is a blessed. Therese Newman, who died in the 1960s.
Yeah.
She is, I think, servant of God, close to being blessed. But they both claimed in their visions, they claimed to be able to see things in the life of Jesus, baby Jesus, Blessed Mother, apostles. They both claimed separately that they had seen St. Paul walking around.
And, with signs.
Yeah, and they said to their spiritual director, right, Father, it is an interesting thing.
Hmm.
He, by the way, was the first stigmatist. People think it's Francis,
right.
but it was Paul.
That's incredible.
I saw him walking around with the wounds of Christ.
Yeah.
So that would be private revelation.
Sure, but
sure.
You're not going to find that in the catechism anywhere, but you know, that's what they claim to have seen.
And I mean, if it aligns with Scripture, it makes sense. And Paul also says that, you know, we're to be conformed to the image of the Son.
Yeah.
And what more perfect way to be conformed to the image of the Son than to bear his wounds, which he had after the resurrection.
Right.
It would almost seem contradictory if Christ didn't continue to have his wounds, that these people would then have them.
Right.
But because he showed, even in his glory, that wounds are still part of it, then as we live in, you know, the glory of the kingdom now, that wounds are still an aspect of our life.
Well, and Protestants ask, they wear bracelets and so forth, WWJD, what would Jesus do? He would suffer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then he would say to everybody, if you want to follow me, pick up your cross and follow me. And several of the stigmatists said, you want to know what the most vexing wound is? It's not this thorn in my head that bleeds. It's not the wound on the side. It's this shoulder wound.
Yeah, Bernard of Clairvaux talks about that.
Yeah, it doesn't bleed, but it hurts.
From the rubbing
most.
Of the cross, basically.
And Jesus told me that of all the wounds that he had, that one is the most painful. That's the most vexing of all the wounds.
That's incredible.
So when you think about that theologically, right, if you want to follow me, pick up the cross and follow me. The fact that that would be the most vexing wound is theologically pretty profound.
Hmm. Right.
And by the way, Jesus doesn't say, if you want to follow me, get yourself a nice retirement account. Right? Make sure you get a vacation every year. You know, make sure you leave all your money to your kids so they don't have to work as hard as you.
Right.
Right? No, if you want to follow me, suffer.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Pick up the cross and follow me.
Exactly.
That's what he says.
And I think the irony is sometimes people think that the health and wealth gospel is almost more appealing or more comforting, like, you come to Jesus and boom, things are going to work out great for you.
Baby.
But I think in reality, you know, as your life actually plays out for a while, the Catholic message is much more comforting because you realize, like, otherwise
reality.
You almost feel, that's reality. We're all going to suffer every day to some extent. And I think you can almost, as a Christian, feel gaslit if you're being told, if you're a faithful Christian and you're loved by God, then things should be going well for you and you're not going to ever suffer. Then you're going to, when inevitably suffering comes, you're going to say, what's wrong with me? But with Catholicism, it's like, no, the suffering, that's part of life. That's not just that's part of life. That's almost some of the greatest parts of life in the reversal of kind of how this works.
And you walk into your church every Sunday like you're required to do, and maybe even daily Mass, and you walk in and you see that Jesus hanging on the cross, all bloodied and beaten, and you think, oh yeah, that's what they did to him.
Yeah.
So they did to the Son of God.
Yeah.
Well, then so and so has cancer, but he suffered too, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're visually reminded of that. And again, people who might walk into, non-Catholics who might walk into our houses, you got all these crucifixes with Jesus, bloody Jesus. It reminds you of that suffering when you're walking around your house.
Yeah.
In the artwork, the Pieta.
Yes.
Right? You know, Mary, I remember hearing one Catholic convert, maybe she was on The Journey Home, one of those shows, and she had watched The Passion by Mel Gibson for the first time, and she was non-Catholic. And she said at the very end, just seeing Mary, the agony of Mary at the foot of the cross, and she said, oh, yeah, now I get it. She's his mother.
Right.
Mind-blowing.
Right.
Yeah.
So she's watched her son get tortured and die.
Right.
She's in agony.
Yes.
Right, the mother of suffering at that point. So that then you start to piece it together.
Yeah.
You're right. It's more comforting.
It is
because it's more truthful about reality, about life.
Yeah, it's kind of natural to us to, or not natural, but we have this fallen inclination, I think, to associate suffering with evil, and that, like, the more evil a person you are, the more you're going to suffer. We would hope that works out that way, and you know, the better you are as a person, the more you're just going to have a happy life all the time. But then. Yeah, like you say, there's kind of people always voice that question, why does God let bad things happen to good people? But the most good person, Christ, suffered more than any other human. And probably the person who suffered second most after Christ was his mother, who was the next most good person. So it's actually, the more good of a person you are in this life, you're probably going to suffer more. So.
Yeah, Fulton Sheen always said, right? No cross, no crown. Right? No pain, no gain. No cross, no crown.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's the problem. Sheen always says, he was the one person who was born into the world to die.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah,
that's hardcore.
He was born into this world to die.
That's incredible.
That was his whole mission, his whole point. At the age of 33, By the way, that's
which a lot of stigmatists tend to die at 33.
Yeah, Catherine of Siena, Faustina, both died at the age of 33. A number of the women, interesting too, maybe theological, well, I don't know, maybe biological, I don't know how you want to describe it, but 90% of those stigmatists have been women.
That's just something I wanted to ask you about. If you, I know you mentioned, I watched the interview with Father Mitch for EWTN, and you talked about that, but I was wondering if you thought that there was a reason why it was more women.
I quote some different people on that who've speculated on it. I was glad I could, because I had my own kind of theories that I think match with theirs. But I think women are more willing to suffer in a kind of loving, self-sacrificial way. Mm-hmm. I mean,
labor.
Labor and also you know, you guys know my family well. We have 8 kids and. Yeah. In the middle of the night when one of the babies was crying, you know, I would just like roll over and my wife says, "Is he okay?" I'm like, "I don't know. I don't care." You know, but she just jumps up and like, you know, salutes the flag. It goes in, takes care of the kid.
Right.
And they just seem to, they have a more of a kind of loving, emotional, sacrificial way that I think allows them to do that better than a guy does. My wife will say all the time, you know, you're such a wimp, right? Because I'll be complaining about a pulled muscle after working out. And she's like, "Do you realize that I've had this shoulder injury, whatever, and I still teach class 10 days a week?" And it's like, "No, I didn't realize."
Fitness class, you mean? Yeah.
She teaches fitness classes.
Right.
But they, I think women are better at that. Than men are.
I think that makes a lot of sense. I was also thinking about it from the point of like, the nature of a woman is to be receptive.
Right.
And what better, you know, I mean, you can't receive more than to receive like Christ himself.
Yeah.
And so the receptivity of receiving Christ in his woundedness, as his mother received him in his woundedness, you know, a man can't receive Christ like his mother can, but a woman can.
That's very good.
And so like in having more stigmatists to be women, he's asking them to take the role of his mother for him in a special way. And especially because there's the...
I wish I would have thought of that.
I wonder if Mary had some form of the stigmata.
Somebody asked me that. That was somebody said, it was a recent interview, and she put in a really interesting way about bearing, the presentation of the temple.
Yeah, the sword is piercing her soul.
Yeah, and a dagger shall pierce your heart, right? And maybe, so Christ was pierced on the cross, so maybe was Mary the first to be pierced in a way.
Right.
So in that sense, kind of the first stigmatist. And I guess maybe you could argue that way in a sense, right? Mm-hmm. But in terms of like what we think of stigmata, the wounds of the passion, hands, feet, side, that would be other people. That'd be probably St. Paul, St. Francis.
Right.
And many women.
Yes.
Yeah. Right.
More women than anybody else. And most of, geographically, about 70% have come from Italy.
Your home country. Which,
And I, part of that is...
Italians, yeah.
Well, I bet 70% of saints are from Italy.
There really are so many.
Probably. But however, if... I quote some different authorities on that, too, say, well, it's kind of in the nature of Italian people, right? They're very emotional. And my mom's side is 100% Italian, some over 50% Italian. And I could see that. I could see that in Italian people as well. So it makes sense to me that... so many of them would be Italian women, right? Catherine of Siena, Elena Aiello, Gemma Galgani. You know, you guys have a niece named Gemma.
Yes,
You know, through Gemma Galgani,
And so they're kind of the prototype, in a way, of these stigmatists.
Maybe it's God's loving way of getting a little bit of revenge on the Roman descendants, because the Romans were the ones who pierced him, so he'll pierce their descendants now.
That's
terrible.
Thought about, you know, St. Paul says, where sin abounds, grace abounds all the more. And, I mean, Italy has been the epicenter for so much war and division and conflict.
And corruption in the church.
I mean, some of the worst sinners were our popes.
Catherine of Siena talks about
exactly. She confronted, was it Boniface the VII, I think?
The Avignon Pope.
Yes, yeah.
Right. And she tells them, you know, basically, buckle up, you coward, right? Go back hardcore. To Rome.
Yeah.
And in one of, I've gotten a lot of comments about this, in the dialogue, her dialogue. It's hard to find a full copy of her dialogue.
Well, I found this very fascinating.
Has it been censored?
Yes. Okay. Because big sections of it, the sections on homosexuality are excised out in a lot of modern versions.
Really?
And so this is to your point on corruption in the church and what's going on in Italy at the time. Mm-hmm. And she's claiming to be spoken to, in this case, by God the Father himself. Mm-hmm. Right? Not Jesus, but God the Father. And he says to her, I wiped out 5 entire cities because of the sin of homosexuality.
Oh my gosh!
I know it's
biblically
really,
like the ones like Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yeah, because I thought, well, Sodom and Gomorrah, what else, right? Yeah. But if you go in the Old Testament, there's actually 5 cities that are named altogether. And then he says he tells her that he decries homosexuality among clergy, corrupt clergy at that time.
At that time,
which
is 700 years ago.
Yeah, like 1370. Like
that's crazy.
1370. And he tells her that it is such an abominable sin, so horrific and repulsive that even the demons flee the scene when they see it acted out. The demons are happy to lead those people into perdition and sin, but when the act occurs, they flee because they stem from an angelic nature, a fallen angelic nature, right?
They know what is natural.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So they recoil at it. But that's all in her original dialogue, and people have taken it out today.
Wow.
They've taken it out altogether.
And I mean, that speaks to, like, to today so much. I mean, when the grand jury report came out and the sexual scandal of the church among clergy, I mean, they talk about, you know, the joke, whatever, it's awful, but, like, if you were an altar boy in that that time frame, like, they were probably abused because it was boys mostly. You know,
yes,
homosexual
far more than
scandal.
Girls. Yeah,
it was homosexual in nature. It was male to male.
Yeah,
rarely was it male to female.
Mm-hmm. So just that what she was speaking to in that moment then 700 years ago,
it's homosexuality.
And so many of the prophetic messages that the stigmatists received are very applicable. Mm-hmm. Even almost sometimes it seems like from both what I've heard and, you know, based off your reading from your book, more applicable today, even.
That was one of the main reasons that I wrote this, was because there is a commonality in their predictions about end times.
Yeah.
About end times, chastisement, ball of fire from the sky, great deluge, a chastisement worse than the great deluge.
Oh my gosh.
I know, this is Blessed Elena Aiello. Said this, days of darkness, a number of them talk about days of darkness. Mm-hmm. In fact, the 3 days of darkness, if you Google it, the first thing that pops up is a Wikipedia entry, and it attributes the 3 days of darkness to Blessed Anna Maria Taigi from the
1700s. She was a stigmatist, right?
She was a stigmatist. I didn't know she was a stigmatist. I didn't know it until I didn't remember how I came about noticing it. I think I was doing research on how many of them predicted 3 days of darkness, days of darkness. Sister Elena Aiello was told 70 hours of darkness. And there could be a mistranslation. I wonder if it's like 72 or something.
Right.
Either way, 70 is going to feel like 3 days.
Yeah, right.
Close enough. Faustina Kowalska talks about days of darkness. She doesn't specify the number as 3, but she talks about days of darkness. And she's the one that was told. So she's the first saint of the new millennium, canonized by John Paul
in 2000.
In 2000. And she was told by Jesus, you will prepare the world for my second coming. Mm-hmm. And he tells her there will be this period of darkness, and the only thing that will penetrate the darkness will be the sign of the cross in the sky, right? And from Jesus, I'm kind of picturing from the wounds of Jesus emanating from the sky, almost like you see the wounds of Jesus on the cross at San Damiano with Francis.
Yeah, the rays
penetrate. Exactly. Yeah, San Giovanni Rotondo Chapel with Padre Pio, with Catherine of Siena. That's right there. She's receiving that. It's
invisible wounds in her case, right?
Right. Yeah. My son Mitch was at that exact. He sent me a picture of that cross at that church.
Goodness, that was amazing.
I wanted to go to Siena.
Yeah, it was that Jesus on the cross that the rays came out and pierced them. Faustina, the same way. It's a Divine Mercy image. But in the Divine Mercy, really image of images in the end times, it will be that those rays of light coming from the sign of the cross in the sky that illuminates the world and breaks the darkness. So all of these people have these days of darkness prophecies. And the other one who, this is really striking, the Our Lady of Akita seer in Japan.
Yeah, this was very interesting to me.
Sister Agnes Sasagawa, who just died.
Yeah.
This year, right?
This year. She died in the summer of 2020.
That's incredible.
Yeah, in her 90s. So when I was writing the book, in fact, I looked this up recently to go back to see what I wrote about, and I referred to her as still living, mm-hmm. right? Because the book, at the time I was writing the book, she was still alive. But she's the one who had the October 13th, 1973 prophecy. That would be the anniversary of the miracle of the sun.
Yeah, Fatima. Yeah.
October 13th, 1917. And in fact, Bishop Ito of Japan, who approved of her vision, seeing that approved of her, what happened to her as being of supernatural origin. That was the wooden statue of Mary that cried blood and tears,
right.
Which freaked out everybody in Japan. I mean, Japan has almost non-existent level of Christian belief.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
So of all
like
places,
the highest depression rate in the world, too.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, yeah. So for, of all places, for that to be affirmed by Japanese scientists, mm-hmm. I mean, they were really,
it's incredible.
By it. But she was told, her October 13th, Ito said, the message of Akita is the message of Fatima.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a continuation. And she was told in that prophecy of October 13th, there would come a time when bishop would be against bishop, cardinal against cardinal, spoke of infiltration of the church, a great chastisement, ball of fire from the sky, worse than the great deluge. And while she was having these visions, she had stigmata.
Wow.
And I mean, I didn't know she had stigmata.
Did they leave her?
I read Ito's letter.
Okay.
And she had them in one hand, okay. I think the left hand, and for a limited period of time.
Okay.
And we knew so little about her when she died in her mm-hmm. early 90s, mm-hmm. at this point just a few months ago. So I don't think she had stigmata a lot longer mm-hmm. after that. Prior to that, she had been cured of deafness,
mm-hmm. wow,
which is why she was put in the convent where she was. And the Blessed Mother spoke to her and said, you will be cured of your deafness.
Huh.
And she was. And again, the Japanese that affirmed that is like,
yeah, there's no,
the nun can hear.
Yeah.
She can hear now.
And they're unbiased, you know, because they're probably not Christian. No chance of that.
That's right.
Yeah.
Totally.
Are there any like other common themes you see in the stigmatists? Because I know you said it's obviously the stigmata is its own charism in a way, and there's obviously lots of charisms in the church. Some people are preachers, some people are healers. But do you see any common themes in, I don't know, their temperaments or anything about their lives?
Spiritual anedia, they call it. People who don't need much to eat.
Or
sleep.
Okay.
Therese Newman and Anne Catherine Emmerich, in their final decades, lived on nothing but the Eucharist.
Mm-hmm.
So Therese Newman, for like over 40 years.
Catherine of Siena did for a long period of time, too.
Yeah, she did, too. That's exactly right. And in fact, Anne Catherine Emmerich, last decade of her life, nothing but the Eucharist and water. So by the way,
Did she lose a lot of weight? Was she like...
No, that's a really remarkable thing. Now, Catherine of Siena, I think at the end of her life, she was 33.
Mm-hmm.
And she was just like Faustina. I mean, sick. And kind of getting, you know, very skinny, suffered from other ailments. But Therese Newman and Anne Catherine Emmerich, kind of larger German women. I mean, Therese Newman doubled her weight from like 130 to like 210.
From the Eucharist?
Well, during that time. Yeah, during the...
That's
during,
incredible.
And the doctors, the German doctors who weren't believers, like, I can't explain it. All she eats daily is this thing that they call their Eucharist.
Mm-hmm.
She eats nothing else. We try to give her regular food, and she vomits it up.
Oh my gosh!
And yet she couldn't still keep gains it down. Weight.
Yeah,
right. Yeah.
So as if you want to bulk,
almost
I guess,
as if.
Sorry.
Right.
Wow. I just like.
That's physically impossible.
Well, yeah. First of all,
right.
Miraculous. But that the only thing that she could receive the Eucharist because nothing else was good enough. Nothing else was pure enough.
Mm-hmm.
Having received like the wounds of Christ in her body, the only thing that she could receive was more of Jesus.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, think about that. That's really spiritually profound. The other commonality is they all go through periods of intense suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Like near the end of their life, horrible abscess or whatever that looks like it's not going to heal, mm-hmm. go through an operation, Blessed Elena Aiello, where some doctor butchers her, and
oh my
the other doctor comes in and says, there's nothing I can do for her.
Yeah.
This doctor absolutely just destroyed her. You know, over and over again, looks like they're going to die.
Mm-hmm.
They get through it.
And they heal.
And they heal. And then eventually, different miraculous interventions. St. Rita of Kasha, mm-hmm. in the case of Elena Aiello. And then eventually, they kind of get through that, and then they get gifted with the stigmata. So it's almost as if Jesus or the powers of heaven are testing
them. Preparing them.
Yeah, mm-hmm. to see if they have, like, the spiritual, physical metal to go, and he'll say, "Are you willing to go further for me now, my daughter?"
It's like training them.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
that's intense.
Oof. And then one day they're in front of a cross, and you know, bam.
That's crazy.
Like, I didn't expect that. Yeah. Catherine of Siena, hide these. Mm-hmm. I don't want anyone to see this. Hide these.
Yeah.
So in her case, they were hidden, and in Faustina's as well. Mm-hmm. Most cases, though, they're open. They're out in the open.
Mm-hmm.
Gemma Galgani was that way.
Mm-hmm.
And she lived 1878 to 1903, so basically the same years as the pontificate of Leo XIII.
Wow.
And your brother Thomas, so his daughter is named Gemma.
Yeah.
And I remember Thomas telling me, and he tipped me off on this when I was researching Gemma Galgani. And after that, I found like 6 or 7 examples. Exorcists who say that Gemma Galgani has become a really powerful accompaniment.
Wow.
During really difficult exorcisms. And it's not a surprise when you look at when she was like the female Padre Pio.
Yeah.
The devil would just hellaciously, and the demons would beat her up. I mean, in most cases, the devil's no gentleman, right? So it's not like he's going to leave the girl.
Right. So
Padre Pio all the time is getting beat, pounded. Guys outside of his cell in the middle of the night can hear him yelling and screaming.
Mm-hmm.
He would ask another brother sometimes to stay in the room with him because the demon would act up.
Oh.
But this would happen to Gemma Galgani, too. People talked about walking in the room and seeing this girl being dragged across her hair.
Oh, my gosh.
By some invisible force. And so she dealt with it all the time, learned to almost laugh it off, told her spiritual director, "Oh, Father, that ugly little black thing the other day, you know, I held up the crucifix and he went running out of the room, tripling. It was so hilarious. How ridiculous." And he's like, don't joke. Just
she maybe can, though.
Yeah. Faustina talks about writing in her diary and the demon comes over and she just picks up the crucifix as she's writing. She's like
that's
right?
Intense.
And then just
that's so metal. That's awesome.
I know. Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, incredible. I remember Tom was telling me about one particular exorcism. One of the priests didn't realize that he had a relic of Saint Gemma on him.
Wow.
But it was like in his cassette pocket or something. And they were trying the exorcism, and the demon was not leaving, but he kept on saying, "Why is she here? Why is she here?" And he was thinking like Our Lady or something.
Yeah.
But then like one of the other assistants said something. It's like, no, you have a relic. And he says, oh yeah, St. Gemma. And he pulled the relic out and the demon went nuts.
Yeah, yeah.
And he says, "I hate her. I hate her.
Right.
And then it's gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I quote another exorcist who said in print exactly that. And they said, "Who is it? Who's the woman in black?" They think maybe it's the Madonna, or maybe it's the Blessed Mother. It's like, "No, Gemma, I hate her. She makes me sick." And in one case, Mother Teresa appears with her.
Hmm.
And the demon says, "Oh, they're hugging. Oh, I hate them." And the language of these demons, it's filled with hate.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, Gemma Galgani was told at one point by her spiritual director, "You have to start keeping a diary and writing this down." Said, "Well, I don't want to." "No, you have to." So under obedience, she starts writing it down.
Writing down what the demon said?
Everything that's going on in her life. Well, not everything. It's still pretty sparse, but daily she would write a few things. And once she starts this diary, the demon comes in one day and takes it.
Oh,
and
wow.
He's walking off with, like, you know, the notebook, and he's yelling at her, war, right? Constant war. You just think about this.
What is it? What does it even look like? Does she describe?
She does. She describes these like really ugly, like black, kind of frightening, hideous creatures. And in fact, Anne Catherine Emmerich does too. They give these really vivid descriptions of what they look like. And so, in the case of Gemma, you would think, why would God put this 20-something young girl through this hell of fighting all these demons? Well, keep in mind, as she's doing it, she's saying, "Jesus, let me do more for you.
That's incredible.
Me suffer more. When I get into heaven, I'll suffer for you." And the Blessed Mother says, "No, you don't have to then." But what happens to her when she gets to heaven? She ends up becoming maybe one of the most powerful intercessors today.
For exorcism?
For exorcists. I call her Terror of Demons.
I like that.
To borrow the phrase of St. Joseph.
Right.
But she is... So she died in 1903, so that's very recent.
Yeah.
In her case, too, we have all kinds of medical testimony, books by spiritual directors, clergy, cause of canonization. She was canonized very soon after her death.
Yeah, very quickly.
She was 33 when she died?
She was 25.
Oh my gosh. She was one
what
of
am
those,
I doing yeah. with my life?
Right. She was 25. And she was canonized by the 1920s, maybe wow. the 1920s. So she died in 1903. So it didn't take long. Padre Pio took a lot longer. Mm-hmm. Some of these female doctors of the church took a long time to be yeah. canonized. Mm-hmm. It's kind of shocking. Mm-hmm. But in her case, it was quick. And that's especially crazy. Because I think a lot of people around her saw it.
Yeah,
it was... People would come from... Blessed Elena Ayala, who no one knows about it, my longest chapter of the book is on her. She died in 1961. She was born in 1895. She's from Calabria, which is where my family's from.
In Italy, yeah.
And everybody would, I mean, Thursday, here we go, right? Yeah. And everybody come from villages
it would begin.
All around,
yeah.
start filing in, walking up the steps. Mm-hmm. The family's afraid that the roof is going to cave in, the floor is going to cave in, because there's so many people watching her. Mussolini...
That this was, I thought
fire.
So, yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah, definitely had
he respected her.
Attention. Yeah, he wrote a check for her girls' school because she was so impressed by her. Mussolini's sister was so impressed by her. And then she starts writing letters to Mussolini, you know, telling him, Jesus has spoken to me. Mm-hmm. And if you don't stop this right now, collaborating with Hitler, with the Japanese, you're going to be in big trouble.
You're
going to
suffer, yeah.
Yeah, you need to stop. And, you know, he's not sending in the jackbooted thugs to arrest her. I mean,
no.
he's scared.
Which, yeah.
She's put, a little Italian more scared. Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. 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 Wow. And she told him in one of the final letters, this is your final warning. If you don't, you could go down at this point as one of the greatest heroes in the history of Italy, as a man who created peace. But if you don't change your ways, if you keep cooperating with Hitler and doing this, you're going to disgrace you, your country, your countrymen. And she said a number of times, Rome will be protected because the Vatican is there. Mm-hmm. The chair of St. Peter. God has decided to protect that. Mm-hmm. That's all good. But you're going to disgrace...
Mussolini won't be protected, though.
Right, yeah. She yeah. said, you will suffer a worse fate than Napoleon.
And he did, right?
How could she know that? Napoleon, Waterloo is in 1815.
Yeah.
Then he's exiled to St. Helena, dies like May 1821. I think he died of cancer. You know, a fairly, you know, normal death. Mm-hmm. Mussolini, captured by Italian communist partisans, right? Executed, strung up from a gas
yeah.
station in Milan.
Oh, my gosh.
Next to one of his mistresses. They cut down the rope. He's dragged through the street. They spit on him. They kick him. All kinds of things.
Hall of Fame treatment. Yeah.
Yeah. She, yeah. How'd
That's
she know?
Crazy.
That's
crazy.
And that's, you know, one thing I was, it seems that also not only was God preparing them individually for, to receive the stigmata, but that, like, the world was, they were prepared to do it for the world as yeah. well. That a lot of, especially the major ones that you talk about, were all, right on the brink of something that was happening.
And they're
right?
all visionaries.
St. Francis, you know, on the brink of the collapse and the division of the
right.
church.
Right.
St. Catherine of Siena, the Pope being in Avignon, or the plague, you know, ravaging through Italy.
Yeah.
Wars in city-states of Italy.
Yeah, that's right.
St. Faustina, or St. Gemma on the brink of World War One.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Faustina and, who were you just talking about?
Yeah, Faustina was on the verge
of World War II. Yeah.
1938. In fact, she's the one that was told the world would need an ocean of mercy.
Mm-hmm.
There's even one line in there where Jesus says to her, "Oh, Russia, I can't stand that country anymore,"
mm-hmm.
right? Because of what's
gone rising
on.
Out of it. Wow.
And within a year of her death, 11 months later, the Nazis invade Poland from the west,
yeah.
the Soviets invade from the east, Hitler-Stalin Pact was a week before,
mm-hmm.
World War III is on.
Wow.
And a really cool one that I lead the last chapter with, Anne Catherine Emmerich.
Yeah.
From 1774 to 1824. I think she was 49 when she died. And she was told that the devil had been chained to the floor of hell. By the way, that's in the book of Revelation.
Yeah, yep.
So, I mean, Protestants will know that. I mean, it talks about the devil being chained to the floor of hell and then being let loose at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And Anne Catherine Emmerich said the devil would be chained to the floor of hell, and at a period... 50 to 60 years before the year 2000. Now, they hardly ever give dates, right? And they hardly ever give dates.
Yeah.
3 days of darkness is coming, end time. They never give
dates. They never say when.
They never say when, but she you know, she
very, yeah.
exactly, but she says, 50 to 60 years before 2000, the devil will be unleashed, to basically wreak havoc, wreak hell. Now, that would be 1940 to 1950.
Which, hey, yeah.
World War II, Mao Zedong.
Exactly.
The Soviets.
Yeah. Deadliest war in history, World War II. Dwarfs World War I and deaths. Mm-hmm. That ends, you get peace.
No, Margaret Sanger war. In America. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. Just, well, abortion, I mean, yeah. starts to, I mean, the sexual revolution. The Iron Curtain descends, mm-hmm. right, 1945, 46 to 47. Yeah, the Chinese Civil War, 46 to 49, Mao and the communists take over, October 1949. That's the biggest killing field in history, mm-hmm. next to even above Stalin. So mm-hmm. that's all 1940 to 1950. How in the world could this German nun, who's bedridden
yeah.
in the year 1820, have any idea? I mean, you talk about yeah. nailing a prophecy.
Yeah, right.
That's incredible. And people will say, well, her stenographer, this Clemens Brentano, he exaggerated a lot of this stuff. He was a writer. You know, I think maybe she didn't make it all up, but he surely did. Well, I'll tell you what, if he made up that one, man.
He's pretty good.
Kudos to him.
Round to the nearest apocalypse.
Yeah, let's
yeah.
canonize him. It's
yeah,
pretty good.
Yeah, seriously. That's kind of crazy that, I mean, I would think that prophecy is one gift and the stigmata is another, but it seems like most of these stigmatists also yeah. have prophecy.
Well, and it would, and this is what compels me to take their prophecy seriously, is mm-hmm. the fact that they're stigmatists.
Yeah, right? It's a confirmation. I mean,
it's one thing if your neighbor...
It's a stamp of approval.
Yeah, on Garden Avenue, right? He's out yeah. cutting his grass, and you know, you guys walk by, and he's like, hey, Sam, I've been talking to the Virgin Mary back by the fire pit, right?
Sure,
bud. Go home and tell your dad, it's like, hey, you know, I think Jim down here is really losing it. He thinks he's talking to the Virgin Mary by the fire pit.
We do have some neighbors who smoke pots. So that's what I was thinking.
but if Jim suddenly starts bleeding from his hands and his feet, and word gets around, and the priest is there, and wow, they're sending people from Rome to Jim's house. Doctors
There's
are
something
out there.
About it.
Everybody's been going on for a few years, and by the way, it happens like clockwork on Thursday, Friday.
Yeah.
It disappears.
It's a little weird.
Saturday. Right. Well, now I want to know what Jim's saying to the Blessed Virgin
yeah.
Mary,
yes.
right?
Yeah.
Now I'm going to take him seriously. I mean, if he starts bleeding from his hands,
yeah, right.
Now he's got my attention.
Right. So maybe almost it's like the primary charism God is giving them is their visions or their prophecies, but the way he's proving to the world that those prophecies should be taken seriously is by leaving this stamp
right.
of approval, kind of like...
Right, a physical sign.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
it, for those of us who live way after the, what some Protestants would say, the age of the miracles, right?
Mm-hmm.
The first century with the apostles, mm-hmm. right? Here we are in 18, 19 centuries later. We need signs like that. And
yeah.
I would
yeah.
say, too, people say, well, why would he even do Fatima? Well, we need miracles. We mm-hmm. need to see things like that. When I was an agnostic, I mean, I needed to see things like that to believe.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
I'm like doubting Thomas,
right?
I need to, put my fingers in the wounds. And
yeah,
the hands.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And some people say, well, he was crucified through the wrists, not through the palms. Actually, Thomas says, unless I stick my fingers right in his hands,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So I not through his bony wrists,
right, right,
but through his hands. Mm. So I kind of I like him. I need to see the actual signs.
Yeah.
For proof.
Well, and you're using the word sign. The word sign is within the very definition of a sacrament. You know, an outward
right,
sign
right.
given by Christ by which grace is dispensed to the church, and he is making, asking these people to be sacramental,
mm-hmm.
To become mm-hmm. in yourself, in your own body, a sign of the grace that I desire to give everyone,
yeah.
To the rest of the world.
Right, a living crucifix.
Yeah, yeah. exactly.
If you will. Yeah. Right, right. Yeah.
Yeah, we're all called to be an alter Christus, like another Christ, but it seems like
yeah.
stigmatists are able to really strongly do that. It's almost like, I hope this isn't an unholy observation, they almost seem, from some of the characteristics you were telling that they have, almost like as close as you can get to being possessed by Christ. Like we always hear about possession, like demonic
yeah,
possession.
Not in the sense of demonic. Right,
right, but it seems like the fact that they have this bodily affliction.
Filled with Christ.
They're filled with Christ. Even like just the one detail where a lot of them can't eat anything but the Eucharist.
Yeah, it's
there's
amazing.
A lot of people who are demonically possessed who they can't eat the Eucharist. If they like eat it,
right,
they vomit.
Right.
And we have the reversal with the stigmatists. So it's like...
Yeah, and by the way, some people will say, how do we know that these aren't demonic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, because of the lives of these people.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
yes. Yeah.
Saints, and because of things like that.
Right.
Right, like in cases of major exorcisms, exorcists will say, when it gets really bad, I'll need to bring out the heavy artillery, right? We'll consecrate the Eucharist. I'll bring it out. I'll hold it up. And, you know, all of a sudden, things screaming and jumping all over the place.
Yeah.
Right? You would not be able to put it on the tongue of Anne Catherine.
Right.
I mean, yeah, that you hit the person with holy water, they start yelling and screaming, right? So, this is the complete opposite. Right. And these visions that they have are not unholy or in any way demonic. I mean, they are things that never contradict, as far as we can tell, Scripture, the faith, right?
Yeah, so it's those accusations by those doubters would kind of just be like the Pharisees back in Jesus' time saying, like, oh, he's driving out demons by demonic power.
Well,
just look at his lifestyle. It's obviously not true. So
And really, these ought to be even more powerful to us, because here we are in the 21st century, and if somebody's walking around like this, bleeding in their hands, I mean, how can we deny that? That we could see it with our eyes,
right?
And it's so other to us. It's so it's unnatural. It's
because
counter. Well, the last question I would have for you, Dr. Kengor, maybe a little bit away from the history, but just for you personally, how have you, like personally in your own spiritual life, maybe, or in your own prayer, grown through this work? I mean, how could, you know, for people who are listening, I'm sure enjoying all of the history and the ideas of prophecy and everything, how could they enter into the spirituality of stigmatism without necessarily bearing it physically?
Yeah, I mean, I would just say my advice would be that any of these different really holy men and women, and the seven that I focus on in the book are mostly all canonized saints. If they're not, then they're blessings, right? I would say read any of the books about them, read any of their diaries, and it's just spiritually edifying, and it will help you to lead a more holy life. It's like I said earlier in this interview, two of the stigmatists that I talk about in the book, both died at the age of 33, Catherine of Siena and Faustina Kowalska, one also Gemma Galgani. I have their books next to my bed all the time. And, you know, if I'm feeling whatever, feeling down or feeling terrible about the state of the world and the culture and the country, which pretty much describes all the time, but I'll just crack open Faustina's diary and just start reading a few sections.
And
Gemma's as well. And they have a way of looking at the world and the times that's timeless that immediately picks you up and kind of sets you straight. They take you to another place. So I'd say the fact that they have the literal markings of Christ, which is almost like an imprimatur, if you will, right? A stamp of approval on how special they are. It's almost like an imprimatur too to their writings, to their diary. So for me, I would just say any of those different individuals, read about their lives. The lives of the saints inspire us so much. And read about Catherine of Siena, Padre Pio, Francis of Assisi, Faustina, Gemma Galgani. They're all just great and edifying for your soul and for your Christian faith, your Christian walk.
Absolutely. And where can anyone from our audience find that book?
Yeah, so you get it at Tan Books.
Okay.
So
we can probably just put a link.
We'll put a link in the description for a way to connect to find the book.
Tan Books, Amazon, wherever you order books.
Okay. There you go. Fantastic.
Yeah, offer what you just said, I was reminded of a quote from Francis de Sales, which he said, "Do not ignore spiritual reading, for by it many people have become saints."
Yeah, right. Yeah. I totally agree. At night, at the end of a long, difficult day of living in modern times, you know, don't sit down and read a book by Karl Marx. You'll go to bed feeling even more awful about the world.
World's going to hell in a handbasket.
Right. Yeah. It's like... you know, every morning for Mass, right? You know, we read Scripture. That's how we start our day. And I would say at night, close your day by reading something edifying from the saints.
Yeah,
absolutely. Better than doom scrolling, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah, you don't want to end your day with dopamine. End it with some exemplary holiness.
End it with Catherine of Siena.
Yeah,
yeah. She's. I absolutely love Saint Catherine of Siena.
She's great.
I definitely have. Of all of the stigmatists that you mentioned, I have the strongest devotion to her.
I do too. She's really special.
There's something, you know, Christ says, "It is not you who chose me, but I who chose you," when he's talking to the apostles. I believe that also holds in those saints that we have relationships with. It's not like us who just like, "Oh, your story is so cool. Like, I want to be."
Right.
And there's, I think there's that initial But I also believe that, that saints have chosen certain people to foster a relationship
it
with.
It seems like it, doesn't it?
Because it is, we're disposed to understanding Christ in a way that maybe they did too.
Sure.
So,
and a lot of them are more relatable.
Yeah, exactly. Then. Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to relate to Jesus.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
It really
being
is.
Being sinless, yeah.
Kind right. Of. But I can relate to Padre Pio.
Right.
Right. You know, complaining about this and the pain and everything. And I mean, that's more relatable.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah,
this was a lot
so
of
much.
Fun.
Thanks everybody for watching. And,
yeah.
And, you know, tell all your friends about these guys. This is
that
would be great.
Let's go. Appreciate that. And check out the book. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Thank you very much, Dr. Kengor. Appreciate you all for joining. Have a wonderful and God bless day.
God bless.
Peace.